It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4 to 1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
We will, I suppose, have this debate again next week, if we ever get there. It's getting late. I would ask you, respectfully, if we could simply start. Maybe tomorrow we can start. And they can make their argument. And they can, I guess, make a case that they once called overwhelming. We'll see. But this resolution is right, and it's fair, and it makes sense. You have a right to hear what they have to say before you have to decide these critical issues. That's all this is about. Is it now, or is it a week from now? Seriously, can we please start? Thank you.
That was last night. After about 12 hours of listening to Adam Schiff and Gerald Nadler and other Democrats make their plea about the rules of what was going to happen in this impeachment trial. Not the case for impeachment, just the rules. That's Pat Cipollone. And they talked about 12 hours yesterday. Did you see any of it? I saw some of it. I mean, it's very hard to watch. It's very hard not to drift off, to get into life. Who can sit and listen to this? Tomorrow we will open the phone lines because I'm not saying don't listen. I'm just saying it's hard. It takes discipline to make yourself sit there and listen to this. I think Adam Schiff and Gerald Nadler both they're just so angry and insulting. I don't know where they get all that rage. That would exhaust me, but they're always unhappy and they had lots to say. And the thing that struck me, of course, was that they were just not telling the truth. I noticed yesterday, I was listening to Zoe Lofgren. She stood up to say a few words, and she made the statement that and I can't find the piece of paper, so I'll do it by memory. She said that in the transcript, in the phone call with President Trump and the president of Ukraine, it clearly demonstrated that he had threatened to withhold aid if the president did not do investigations into the Bidens, and that's just a lie. It's absolutely not the truth. And I'm thinking, don't they take an oath before they go on the Senate floor to tell the truth when they deliver their remarks? Because witnesses have to raise their hand and say, we swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And now less often than used to be, they don't always say, so help me God, but they do swear to tell the truth. So why do senators and congressmen feel free to lie? Because believe me, I've had a front row seat in those chambers to listen to them lie. But last night for the 12 hours, we heard lots of them. It was so bad. I have to say Politico, which is no right-leaning. It's a source of information that's really used by political types. It's very D.C.-centric, and it certainly isn't conservative. And their headline last night, Schiff may have... He may have mischaracterized Les Parnas evidence documents show. It all boils down to a Schiff. If I get into the weeds too much with this, I'll lose you. But let me just say that the Democrats are claiming they have new evidence against the president by this Les Parnas, who's an associate of Rudy Giuliani, and they're trying to make the case that he's close to the president. They actually showed a bunch of pictures. I think Daily Mail published these, and maybe others did too. Pictures of Les Parnas appearing with President Trump, you know, with Ivanka, Jared, probably half dozen pictures of him with them posing. And this is supposed to prove, the claim is that he's very close to him, so the president, so he's close to the family, and so he knows all about what happened with this. But the truth is, I was looking at that and I thought, well, In that case, I must be really close too. I've got pictures of me with Ivanka and Jared and with President Trump. I've got a picture of me sitting right across the table talking to him. I didn't realize we are just thick as thieves. I must know exactly what's going on. It's just not true. You know, when you're in those circles and you're doing those meetings or you're doing events, I think in terms of Parnas's place, he was a fundraiser. You have your pictures taken with them all the time. That's part of the benefit. That's part of what people use then to go raise money and do the things that they do, which is not what I do. But I'm just saying, it's easy to get those pictures if you travel in those circles. It's really silly. It really is. So Schiff is trying to make Parnas into someone who's really close to President Trump, and he actually switched the names in an email to make it seem as though Les Parnas had more connection than he did. I'll make it that simple. So even political, Schiff may have mischaracterized Parnas evidence. So that's the way it went for like 12 hours. Griff Jenkins actually had a thorough report this morning on Fox and Friends. Let's listen to how Griff characterizes it. Here it is. Here it is.
They say nothing good happens after midnight. That's why shortly before 1 a.m., Chief Justice Roberts had to rein things in, citing a 1905 precedent when one of the House managers back then in a federal judge case used the word pettifogging, which essentially means putting an undue amount of emphasis on petty details. And it is the cover-up accusations, the dishonesty accusations of the House managers, which was a part of it. Here is some of what we heard from Mr. Nadler and Schiff.
I see a lot of senators voting for a cover-up, voting to deny witnesses, an absolutely indefensible vote, obviously a treacherous vote.
President Trump gave his word he would drain the swamp. We've seen his personal lawyer go to jail, his campaign chairman go to jail, his deputy campaign chairman convicted of a different crime. The list goes on and on.
He was also, Chief Justice Roberts, that is, also upset with the personal attacks. At one point, Pat Cipollone, the White House, leading the White House's team, taking a stab at Nadler. But it was the first time we heard from Trump's defense team and their case that they were making that basically the discovery period is over. Listen.
The time for the House managers to bring their case is now. They had their chance to develop their evidence before they sent the articles of impeachment to this chamber.
They're asking you to use your office to remove your political opponent from the ballot. That's wrong. That's not in the interest of our country. And to be honest with you, it's not really a show of confidence.
3 a.m., they passed down party lines, 53-47, Majority Leader McConnell's framework for this trial. McConnell hasn't ruled out witnesses. We could possibly get there next week. 11 amendments by Minority Leader Schumer shot down. No Republican crossing the aisle except for one, Senator Susan Collins, on one amendment over allowing briefs, making that a 52-48 vote. But really only time will tell whether or not Schumer's strategy of trying to get all this out there and what was a marathon day will work or not. It all resumes again at 1 o'clock today with a lot of sleepy senators and certainly an exhausted Chief Justice, I presume.
Yeah, they've added a day to the testimony, too. That was one thing that Schumer kept presenting amendment after amendment to the rules that Mitch McConnell had laid out to conduct the trial. And so that's what took them 12 hours. That's why Cipollone said, can't we get to the trial? Can't we get to the trial? Can we please? Can't we just hear the evidence? And that's the way it went yesterday. There's a lot more to say about that, but you'll hear it. If you turn on television, you'll hear it nonstop. I want to talk about Davos. The president is at the Economic Forum in Davos. He just did a press conference a few minutes ago, but this is a portion of what he said at somewhere in the last 24 hours. He delivered these remarks, clip 14.
Since my election, America has gained over 7 million jobs. Just last week alone, the United States concluded two extraordinary trade deals, the agreement with China and the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement. As a result of our efforts, investment is pouring into our country. We've regained our stride, rediscovered our spirit, and reawakened the powerful machinery of American enterprise. America is thriving. America is flourishing, and yes, America is winning again like never before.
All right, that was part, just a tiny part. You know, this speech that he gave in Davos, now these are some of the wealthiest men in the world. Maybe they are the wealthiest. I don't know what the metric is, but there were like tons of private planes there. They're deciding on where to invest in the world, and the president was there to persuade them to invest in the United States. I heard his speech, the president's speech, described as one of the best he's ever given on economics, and so I just read it this morning, and I'm going to read as much of it as I can to you, because you're never going to hear this if I don't. It really was incredible. I think whoever said it was great was right. So I'm going to give you a little taste of this. He's speaking, he said, when I spoke at this forum, let me just give the groundwork. When he spoke to them a few years ago, when he first took office, they were skeptical of him. The Europeans, you know, they're not fans. They weren't. They did not treat him, I don't think, with tremendous respect, but that's an aside. And he told them it was going to be America first, and he told them what he was going to do. And when he came into office, of course, our economy was in really bad shape. He's coming back to say, look, this is what we did, and it worked. But I want you to hear this. When I spoke at this forum 2 years ago, I told you that we had launched the Great American Comeback. Today, I'm proud to declare that the United States is in the midst of an economic boom the likes of which the world has never seen before. We've regained our stride, we discovered our spirit, and awakened the powerful machinery of American enterprise. America is thriving, America is flourishing, and yes, America is winning again like never before. And I'm skipping around. He said, when I took office 3 years ago, America's economy was in a rather dismal state. Under the previous administration, nearly 200,000 manufacturing jobs had vanished, wages were flat or falling, almost 5 million more Americans had left the labor force than had gotten jobs, and more than 10 million people had been added to the food stamp rolls. The experts predicted a decade of very, very slow growth, or maybe even negative growth, high unemployment and a dwindling workforce, and very much a shrinking middle class. Millions of hardworking, ordinary citizens felt neglected, betrayed, forgotten. They were rapidly losing faith in the system. He said, before my presidency began, the outlook for many nations was bleak. Top economists warned of a protracted worldwide recession. The World Bank lowered its projections for global growth to a number that nobody wanted to even think about. Pessimism had taken root deep in the minds of leading thinkers, business leaders, and policymakers. Yet despite all of the cynics, I had never been more confident in America's future. I knew we were on the verge of a profound economic resurgence if we did things right, one that would generate a historic wave of investment, wage growth, and job creation. And then he goes on and said, I knew that if we unleashed the potential, and then he goes through all the stats. They are amazing. I'm using his word. They are amazing. We've gained over 7 million jobs. The projection was 2 million, and they've hit 7 million. The unemployment rate is now at 3.5%, the lowest in 50 years. The average unemployment rate is the lowest for any president in recorded history. For the first time in decades, it talks about how the middle class and how the economic situation has improved their situation. African Americans, Hispanic Americans, and you know those stats, so I'm going to skip over that part. He said, in the 8 years before I took office, over 300,000 working-age people left the workforce. In just 3 years of my administration, 3.5 million people have joined the workforce. 10 million have been lifted off welfare in less than 3 years. He talks about the blue-collar boom. He says, I see such tremendous future, potential for the future. Time for skepticism is over. And then he talks about our country more, but he says, we achieved this stunning turnaround not by making minor changes, by adopting a whole new approach. A nation's highest duty is to its own citizens. Only when governments put their own citizens first will people be fully invested in their national futures. Today, I hold up the American model as an example to the world of a working system, a free enterprise that will produce the most benefits for the most people, pro-worker, pro-citizen. I have to read more of this. I just do. You have to hear more of this because there are such wonderful thoughts, noble concepts, things that make sense. The economy is not separate from God. God is, he talks about money all the time, so this is not a departure from faith. Stay tuned. Sandy Rios in the morning.
Every day, babies in their mother's wombs are fighting for life. with abortion being the leading cause of death.
I already had my mind made up. I was like, I'm going to go through with it.
The Ministry of Preborn has pregnancy centers nationwide, standing by to help young moms in crisis choose life. Preborn is the largest provider of free ultrasounds in the country. By letting a mother see her baby in the womb and hear the heartbeat, she's 80% more likely to choose life for her baby.
When I'm sitting there, the lady is giving me my ultrasound. She's like making these weird faces. She's like, it's two. I just start crying. I was like, I can't.
And sometimes the blessing is doubled. Preborn's mission is to help save babies' lives and souls. To find out more, go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com. Or dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 and say baby. Your love can save a life.
Do you pray for the Great Commission? Hi, it's Bible League International, engaging the world with God's Word since 1938 for only $5 a Bible. At Bible League, we pray that His kingdom will come, and we see it coming in the lives of new Christians eager to grow in the grace and knowledge of Jesus by having their own Bible.
The need for a change is through the Word of God.
It is so important for the Bible, the Word of God, to be made available in whatever languages that are needed by people.
People now are very open to hear the gospel.
Whoever comes and is able to give us a Bible, it will be better than giving us food to eat.
You know, this pastor in Africa is not denying the need for physical nourishment, but he's stressing the need for spiritual nourishment for new believers who cannot access a Bible because they live under corrupt governments or among majority religions that persecute. Will you learn more about becoming a blessing in this kingdom work by visiting sendbiblesnow.org. Sendbiblesnow.org or call 800-YES-WORD. 800-YES-WORD.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes with news and commentary next. Liberty University is preparing students to enter a competitive job market. They have a low student-to-professor ratio, a caring Christian faculty, and more than 550 programs of study, ranging from undergraduate certificates to doctoral degrees. As the largest Christian university in the world, Liberty continues to establish itself as both a leading liberal arts university and an institution dedicated to the Christian faith. Learn more at liberty.edu. That's liberty.edu. Alan Jones is one of the most prominent businessmen in the state of Tennessee. Until recently, he owned Hardwick Clothes, the nation's oldest tailor-made clothing maker. Jones recently sold the company, and the reason why is what I want to share with you. Mr. Jones says it was all about the bottom line. He said Obamacare caused a massive burden on the company, telling the Cleveland Daily Banner that he and his wife were spending $1 million from their own savings account to pay insurance premiums. Then there were the tariffs. When Italians make a suit, they ship that suit to America tariff-free. But if Mr. Jones wanted to use Italian materials to make a suit here in America, well, he would have to pay a 25% tax on the tariff. And even more distressing, many workers balked when he tried to increase the work week from 30 hours to 40, telling the newspaper some workers did not want to give up their government benefits, like free cell phones and food stamps. No wonder he sold the company. I'm Todd Starnes.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
All right, Sandy Rios back with you. I was in the process of giving you some excerpts from the president's speech in Davos, Switzerland. That's where he, as president of the United States, is trying to drum up more business for this country, more investment from wealthy people, entities across the globe. That's what that's all about. And so just to continue this just for a second, then I have a really an amazing story to tell you that I don't think you've heard because nobody's talking about it. So just stay tuned. But this is important too. The president starts out by saying to these very wealthy men, investors, that when he took office 3 years ago, our economy was really in bad shape. Does anybody doubt that? Anybody not remember? Boy, I do. I remember when my husband and I did frequently drive across country from Chicago to D.C. It was about a 12-hour drive. And as soon as we left the D.C. area, it was so apparent what was happening economically through West Virginia, Western Pennsylvania, Ohio. It was so depressing. Oh, my goodness. I remember going into a Burger King that had shut off most of its dining area, had a few tables still up and running, things in disrepair. Car businesses, you know, car dealers shut down left and right. That was one of the first things Obama did. Anybody remember that? People leaving the workforce because they couldn't find jobs. See, what he described, you remember, right? You remember that. I certainly remember that. This is not political rhetoric. This was true. And so he's telling these wealthy business investors what has happened in the United States in the last 3 years. He talks about the 7 million jobs have been gained. The unemployment rate is down to 3.5%. And he says, for the first time in decades, we are no longer simply concentrating wealth in the hands of a few. We're concentrating and creating the most inclusive economy ever to exist. We are lifting up Americans of every race, color, religion, and creed. He says, the American dream is back. It's bigger, better, and stronger than ever before. And then he talks about manufacturing. He talks about pensions going up, college savings accounts, all kinds of things. And he says, I see potential, tremendous potential for the future. We've not even started because the numbers we're talking about are massive. The time for skepticism is over. People are flowing back into our country. Companies are coming back into our country. Many of you are coming back in with your plants and your factories. Thank you very much. America's newfound, now this is really interesting. America's newfound prosperity is undeniable, unprecedented, and unmatched anywhere in the world. America has achieved this stunning turnaround not by making minor changes to a handful of policies, but by adopting a whole new approach centered entirely on the well-being of the American worker. Now, let me move down. Only when governments put their own citizens first will people be fully invested in their national futures. Today, I hold up the American model as an example to the world of a working system of free enterprise that will produce the most benefits for the most people in the 21st century and beyond. The pro-worker, pro-citizen, pro-family agenda demonstrates how a nation can thrive when its communities, its companies, its government, and its people work together for the good of the whole nation. Skipping ahead, he says, today, I urge other nations to follow our example and liberate your citizens from the crushing weight of bureaucracy. With that, you have to run your own countries the way you want. And then he goes on to say, as he admonishes them to adapt America's free principles, he talks about China. That this is kind of funny. He said, our relationship with China right now has probably never even been better. We went through a very rough patch, but it's never, ever been better. My relationship with President Xi is an extraordinary one. He's for China. I'm for the U.S. But other than that, we love each other. He had to throw in a little bit of a Trumpism, which I thought was great. Then he talks about NAFTA. The NAFTA agreement, that was the Canada-Mexico trade agreement. He said that that agreement shifted wealth to the hands of a few, It promoted massive outsourcing, drove down wages, shuttered plants and factories by the thousands. The plants would leave our country, make the product, sell it into, and then sell it into our country. We ended up with no jobs and no taxes. We would buy other countries' products. That doesn't happen anymore. This is the wreckage that I was elected to clean up. It's probably the reason I ran for president, more than any other thing, because I couldn't understand why we were losing all of those jobs to other countries at such a rapid rate. And so then he goes on, he says, we also embraced American energy. The United States is now by far the number one producer of oil and natural gas anywhere in the world. And then he said, at the same time, I'm proud to report that the United States has among the cleanest air and drinking water on earth, and we're going to keep it that way. Someone asked him, a reporter, of course, the Europe is obsessed with climate change and the end of the world. So they shouted at him about climate change, and he basically said back to them, I'm for clean air and clean water. That's all he said in response. He says, we just came out with a report that at this moment, it's the cleanest air and water it's been in the last 40 years. We're committed to conserving the majesty of God's creation and the natural beauty of our world. That's his statement on environmentalism. Isn't that, that is our president to the world, to a world that's just lost and worships the creation and not the creator. I just thought it was pretty stunning. He said, this is not a time for pessimism. This is a time for optimism. Fear and doubt is not a good thought process because this is a time for tremendous hope and joy and optimism and action. But to embrace the possibilities of tomorrow, we must reject the perennial prophets of doom and their predictions of the apocalypse. They are the ears of yesterday's foolish fortune tellers. They predicted an overpopulation crisis in the 60s, mass starvation in the 70s. And I'm here to tell you this is all true. This was the toe, the nose of environmentalism under the tent when I was growing up, that there was a population crisis, that we needed to, you know, reduce birth rates, that people were going to starve in the 70s. The end of the oil, end of oil in the 90s. I have to tell you, they were talking about the end of oil a long earlier than that. We're going to run out of oil. Oh, woe is me. And then he goes on to say, these alarmists always demand the same thing, absolute power to dominate, transform, and control every aspect of our lives. We will never let radical socialists destroy our economy, wreck our country, eradicate our liberty. America will always be the proud, strong, and unyielding bastion of freedom. Now, I want to move down to this. I just am compelled to read this to you this morning. This is what our president is talking about while the nonsense is going on in Washington. And when you watch it, you just feel depressed and defeated. And you wonder where truth is. And you wonder where integrity is and where is high-mindedness. It just seems to be gone in Washington. At least it's a battle over it right now. So the president in Davos goes on to say, for 3 years now, America has shown the world that the path to a prosperous future begins with putting workers first, choosing growth and free entrepreneurs to bring their dreams to life. For anyone who doubts what is possible in the future, we need only look to the towering achievements of the past. Only a few hundred miles from here are some of the great cities of Europe, teeming centers of commerce and culture. Each of them is full of reminders of what human drive and imagination can achieve. Centuries ago, at the time of the Renaissance, skilled craftsmen and laborers looked upwards and built the structures that still touch the human heart. To this day, some of the greatest structures in the world have been built hundreds of years ago. In Italy, the citizens once started construction on what would be a 140-year project, the Duomo of Florence, an incredible, incredible place. While the technology did not yet exist to complete their design, city fathers forged ahead anyway, certain that they would figure it out someday. These citizens of Florence did not accept limits to their high aspirations, and so the Great Dome was finally built. In France, another century-long project continues to hold such a grip on our hearts and our souls that even 800 years after its construction, when the Cathedral of Notre Dame was engulfed in flames last year, such a sad sight to watch, unbelievable sight, especially for those of us that considered it one of the great, great monuments representing so many different things, the whole world grieved. Though her sanctuary now stands scorched and charred, and a sight that's hard to believe, when you got used to it, to look at it now, it's hard to believe. But we know that Notre Dame will be restored magnificently. The great bells will once again ring out for all to hear, giving glory to God and filling millions with wonder and awe. The cathedrals of Europe teach us to pursue big dreams, daring adventures, and unbridled ambitions. They urge us to consider not only what we build today, but what will endure long after we're gone. They testify to the power of ordinary people to realize extraordinary achievements when united by a grand and noble purpose. And now that's not the end of it, but I just wanted you to hear that. I think it is a tremendous speech. We'll put this on our Facebook page so that you can read it and share it. This is your president. This is the one they're trying to impeach today. They're going to start again at 1 o'clock this afternoon. And I just wanted to share that with you. Now, that is not irrelevant to what I'm going to talk to you about next. I talked to you last week about this undercover video that James O'Keefe and Project Veritas did with the field organizer for the Bernie Sanders campaign in Iowa. Do you remember that? His name was Kyle Jurek, and he said basically that if Bernie Sanders didn't win the nomination at the convention in Milwaukee, Milwaukee would burn, policemen would be beaten. He talked about how nice gulags are and how Republicans, Trump supporters need to go to re-education camps. He talked about a lot of other things, a lot of other violent things. Cities will burn if President Trump is reelected, and on it goes. And lots of people were actually asking Bernie Sanders, you should fire this person. You should distance yourself from these remarks. The Democratic candidate should do the same, but just silence. Even Fox didn't cover it. I told you that. very dangerous. So that was Kyle Jurek in Iowa. Well, Project Veritas just came out with another video yesterday of another campaign worker. His name is Martin Weisgerberg. I think that's the name. I'll correct it in a second. Weisgerber. That's his name, Weisgerber. He is in South Carolina. He's the field organizer there for Bernie Sanders. And rather than me telling you, I want you to hear James O'Keefe explain what you're going to hear, and then I'm going to fill in the blanks in case you can't hear exactly what's being said. Let's listen.
Our next Soviet sympathizer from the Sanders campaign is South Carolina field organizer Martin Weisgerber. If you were shocked by our expose on Sanders staffer Kyle Jurek's affinity for the Soviet gulags, hold on, because this guy's got him beat. Weisgerber even suggests dissolving our democracy might be a good start for a Sanders dictatorship.
So, do we just cease? Do we just dissolve the Senate, House of Representatives, the Judiciary Branch, and have somebody like Bernie Sanders and a cabinet of people make all the decisions for the climate? I mean, I'm serious.
Yeah, the executive.
We can't address the immediacy of the climate change occurring.
Gridlock.
Weisgerber laughs about sending the rich to the guillotine, getting armed, and starting a revolution. Words that sound more like they were from the pages of Mao's Red Book than from a Democratic presidential campaign staffer.
Knock on wood. If Bernie was to lose, I would like to see yellow vest protests like here, stateside.
I'm already on Twitter following numerous groups around the country that are ready to organize yellow vest protests.
Okay.
I mean, I'm ready.
Let me know.
I'm ready to start tearing bricks up and start fighting.
Good.
I'm not. I'm no cop, bro. I'll straight up get arms. I want to learn how to shoot and go train. I'm ready for the revolution, bro.
All right.
I'm telling you.
Good stuff.
Guillotine the rich.
Like, I think, I'm of the belief that, you know, I read a little bit about the gulags. I think they're blown a little bit out of proportion. They were mostly for re-education. I think. I don't know. What?
Montana's like, she hears this. Feel for me all
the really?
Yeah.
I thought you guys were like, no way. yeah. But I think they were more for education. I think they're more for education.
The gulags are founded as re-education.
Right. What?
I mean, we have a joke that people we don't like, we say, send them to the gulags.
People we don't like, we say, send them to the gulag. And then he says, guillotine the rich. That's just part of what you may or may not have heard. I'm going to go into this. Remember that Kyle Jurek out of Iowa said last week that the greatest way to break a blanking billionaire of their privilege and their idea that they're superior is go and break rocks for 12 hours. You're now a working class person, and you're going to blanking learn what that means, right? And he talks about re-education, and he says, hey, that's what Bernie Sanders means when he says free education. We have to re-educate. Send to the gulags, all these people that don't have correct thinking. And that was Kyle Jurek. All right, now we're talking about this guy now, same Sanders campaign. This guy's in South Carolina, Martin Weisgerberg. Weisgerber, why do I keep saying that? Weisgerber. And so I want you to hear more carefully now what he's saying. And the reason this relates now, think about the president's speech, one of the many reasons it relates. Think about the president's speech in Davos that I just read to you about freedom, economic freedom. Remember that there is a move afoot. They call it socialism, but honestly, as I think it was Marx who said, or Lenin who said, that socialism is the gateway to communism. They freely admit that. It's just a short breath from there to communism. And some of these people are outright communists. In fact, Martin Weisgerber freely admits he's a communist. His dad was a communist, and so was his mother. His mother works for NPR. There's a lot to tell you about this, and I'm going to do that when we return. I also am going to go back in time because I was very involved in covering the Weather Underground in Chicago. That's a whole other story. It was a radical leftist communist group. The Bill Ayers and Bernadine Doren, the leaders, are still living. They work. They're very influential in Chicago and around the country. And a lot of what they said back in the 60s sounds a lot like what the kids of the Bernie Sanders campaign and others in our public schools and colleges are saying right now. I'm telling you, it is dangerous. So stay tuned. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
For just as the body is one and has many members, and all the members of the body, though many, are one body, so it is with Christ. For the body does not consist of one member, but of many. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Minute. Look briefly at one of your fingers. You've just witnessed one of the greatest displays of God's creative intent there is. No other person in all the world, even an identical twin, shares your fingerprint. God specifically designed each of us to be unique. That means we shouldn't try to carbon copy anyone else in the Christian faith. If God made you an arm in his body or a kneecap, praise be to our glorious God for drawing us to become a part of his body. How freeing it is to realize that we were never meant to copy anyone but Jesus.
Listen each weekday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central for the Hamilton Corner with Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
Regardless of how you leave this world, be ready by having repented and turned to Jesus.
Amen. And just remember, Jesus says it rains on the just and the unjust. Rain is good, but it also can be destructive. We live in a fallen world, and therefore some bad things are going to happen to bad people and to good people.
Exploring the Word, weekday afternoons at 3 Central on American Family Radio. Bishop E.W. Jackson.
A lot of people have become convinced that somehow America is an evil nation, a racist nation, an oppressive nation, a sexist nation, blah, 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 blah.
The Awakening.
I say God bless America and thank God for America, because the whole world is a better place because America exists.
Weekdays at noon Central on American Family Radio.
We're all that we claim to be as a nation and more.
Brian Fisher here with the Life and Liberty Minute. President Trump is the object of a mindless, irrational, unfounded hatred that is blinding in its intensity. Why? He is hated for the same reason that the mobs cried out, "Crucify him," when talking about Jesus, and cried out, "Away with him," when talking about Paul. The president is far from perfect, and many people just don't like him. But their attitude is way past mere dislike and is hateful to a disturbing degree. The explanation is simple. The president has done more to protect the sanctity of life, more to protect religious liberty, and more to protect Israel than any president in 40 years. Who hates the unborn, Christians, and Israel most of all? The Prince of Darkness. Ultimately, hatred for our president comes from the same source. In the name of Jesus, may God protect our president from all the harm intended against him by the evil one.
Catch Brian Fisher on Focal Point, weekday afternoons at 105 Central on American Family Radio.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. At an emergency meeting today, the World Health Organization will consider the danger posed by a deadly new Chinese respiratory virus believed to be spread through the air, from humans to humans, as well as via contact with infected animals. Unfortunately, WHO's deliberations and efforts actually to control the spread of this coronavirus will soon be overtaken by the Lunar New Year, a holiday that sees hundreds of millions of people moving throughout Asia and beyond, mostly in the close quarters of planes, trains, and buses. Making matters worse is the Chinese Communist Party's well-established practice of lying about such public health emergencies. It says there's nothing to worry about. The first case of China's new bug, which is similar to its previous highly contagious SARS and MERS diseases, has shown up in Washington State. We better brace ourselves for many more. This is Frank Gaffney.
Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Donald Trump gets reelected what?
Cities burn.
You didn't think that some of these, like, MAGA people could even be re-educated?
I mean, we gotta try. I mean, like, so, like, in Nazi Germany, after the fall of the Nazi Party, there was a ton of the populace that was Nazified. I mean, like, Germany had to spend billions of dollars re-educating people to not be Nazis. Like, we're probably gonna have to do the same thing here. And that's kind of what Bernie's, like, whole fucking like, hey, free education for everybody. We're gonna have to teach you not to be a fucking Nazi. There's a reason Joseph Stalin had gulags, right? Mm-hmm. And actually, gulags were a lot better than like what like the CIA has told us that they were. Like, people were actually paid a living wage in gulags. They had conjugal visits in gulags. Gulags were actually meant for, like, re-education. Greatest way to break a billionaire of their, like, privilege and their idea that they're superior, go out and break rocks for 12 hours a day. You're now a working class person, and you're going to learn what that means.
All right, I'm going to interrupt. That's the first offering of Project Veritas with James O'Keefe last week. Sandy Rios with you. That was the voice of Kyle Jurek, who is the field operator for Bernie Sanders. That was just a portion of what he said. He said, Milwaukee will burn. We're going to go after the police. Cities will burn if Bernie doesn't get the nomination. We have to re-educate, send to camps Trump supporters. It's just a shocking revelation. More shocking, Bernie Sanders knows this, did not fire him. Of course he didn't fire him, because Bernie Sanders is all about a Soviet worship. He always has been. He knows full well what the gulags are, and he knows full well who's representing him. And so in South Carolina now, James O'Keefe has discovered yet another supporter, Bernie Sanders. Not just a supporter, he's the field operator in South Carolina. For those of you in South Carolina, his name is Martin Weisgerber. And Martin, then, in the second video, and I'm just going to tell you what he says now. We will put these both on our Facebook page. This is what he says. I'll straight up get armed. I'm ready for the blanking revolution. Guillotine the rich. He talks about how wonderful the Soviet Union was. He advocates all Republicans need to go to re-education camps. He says there are a lot of things he talks about. He praises the Soviet Union for inventing the AK-47, wants to get tattooed with an AK-47. I'll straight up get armed. I want to learn how to shoot and go train. I'm ready for the blanking revolution. Let's force those billionaires to build roads, rebuild our roads, rebuild our dams, rebuild our bridges. Let's force them. What will help us is when we send all the Republicans to re-education camps. Then he says, do we just dissolve the Senate, the House of Representatives, the judicial branch, and have something like Bernie Sanders and a cabinet of people make all the decisions for the climate? I mean, I'm serious. The Soviet Union was not horrible. I mean, it was good for women's rights. It was the most progressive place to date in the world. Then he goes on to say that his father was a Belgian Marxist who participated in the May 1967 civil unrest in Paris, France. He said that his mother is really left as well, but she can't make her views known because she works for the WBUR, which is NPR. Now, I want to tell you even more things that he says, because he goes into Okay, he talks about, speaking of gulags and re-education camps, he waxes eloquent on a project known as the Belomor Canal, which was the first gulag in the Soviet Union. Now, I want to read to you exactly what he says about this. The first gulag that was opened was Belomor Canal. They dug a canal. The plan was in 1922, I think, to dig a canal from the White Sea all the way to St. Petersburg. It's a long way. And the whole point, it was going to be called the Belomor Canal. I spent a whole semester actually studying primary accounts from the Belomor Canal. The whole point was that there were no machines allowed. They forced the people to dig with shovels and hole the whole canal, right? You should see the people writing about their time in Belomor Canal. There's this one guy, he was a thief from Georgia. This is Georgia in Russia, who had been captured. He was sent to Belomor Canal to work in his work, and in his writing, he says, like, I reject all thievery. I reject that past life. He said, capitalism made me into this thief, because when there's poor people, there's going to be crime. I went to the Belomor Canal and I worked. I became a shock worker. And then he talks about people came from America to work at the Belomor Canal for the Soviet project, the communist project. It was a beautiful thing. Now, I want to set the record straight about this. And to do that, I'm going to go over to an article written by George Rasley this morning of Conservative HQ. We will put this on our Facebook page, because George does a great synopsis of the statements by Kyle Jurek and also Weisgerber. And he talks about Belomor Canal. So he, of course, both of these guys, Kyle Jurek and Martin Weisgerber, talk about how the gulags are not such bad things. They're not so bad as what? They're not so bad as people think. So here's the truth about it. Alexander Solzhenitsyn called Neftali Frankel, who was Belomor Canal's chief manager of construction, the demon of the archipelago. Some of you are too young to know that Alexander Solzhenitsyn was a Soviet dissident. He was in the gulags for, I don't know, a couple of decades maybe, and he was an intellectual in prison because he was an intellectual and an honest thinker, and finally was freed. But he wrote The Gulag Archipelago, the famous book. You can read it now. And so he calls the guy that was the chief manager of construction the demon of the archipelago. And globalsecurity.org has a whole piece on Belomor Canal. Let me tell you what they say about it. Belomor Canal's historical significance lies in the fact that it was the first time the labor force was exclusively prisoners. By the standards of the rule of law, they were innocent people, especially the peasants. The so-called kulaks in collectivization, that means that's what the Soviets did. They put people in collectives so that they had no freedom and they shared everything equally, and that means they all starved to death. They were all hungry. They all had nothing, just to be clear about what socialism and collectivization does. The kulaks in collectivization deprived of their farms and driven into a work camp. In addition to individual clergy and other class enemies, as representatives of the pre-revolutionary intelligentsia were among the political prisoners, mostly engineers and economists, who, starting with the Schottky case in 1928, were sentenced on false charges of sabotage as the wreckers. So all of these people were in that Belomor Canal and all those gulags. They were the peasants whose farms had been taken away. They were clergy, other class enemies, the intelligentsia who didn't go along with the program. That, you know, that was the case in Cambodia. When I was in Cambodia, they have an S-21 prison where actually it's very well preserved, meaning it's horrible. You can still see bloodstains on the floor. And what the Red Cambodians did was they rounded up in the intelligentsia and they chained them to these beds in this what used to be a school, and they call it the S-21 prison, and they tortured them. Because they simply didn't agree with communism. So that's what they're referring to. So this in these gulags in Russia before Cambodia took place, this is the Russian way, this is the communist way, by the way. Just ask Stalin. Just ask the people in Cuba. Just him. This is what we want. This is what our kids want. This is what they're being taught in public school and colleges. I just want to put this in perspective. Why so many of us get so upset? Do you have any idea? Trying to tell you from one generation to the next, hand down this knowledge. These are documented situations. This is not the stuff of fantasy. And yet our kids are learning fantasy in colleges and universities that the gulags were not so bad. Okay, so here we go. The globalsecurity.org goes on to say the inauguration of Belomor Canal, which is that entity that Martin is bragging about, that was such a great project that it was built not by machines but by hands, by prisoners. And he says it was good, you know, because it changed their mind and kind of bent them to the will of the regime. The inauguration was held on August 2nd, 1933, 6 months after the early completion of the first five-year plan. That was the communist five-year plan. That's what they called it. They always plan. Remember I told you the left plans? They plan, they plan. They plan, they plan. They lay things out and they plan many years ahead. That's why we're always coming up short, because we don't plan like they do. It was the completion of the first five-year plan in anticipation of this upcoming party Congress, the Communist Party Congress. The Congress of Victors in January 1934. It was necessary to conquer two enemies. One enemy was the nature of the Russian North, which was standing in the way of a grand construction project. Another enemy was the pre-revolutionary past, as it continued to live in the minds of the prisoners. That's like you and me. We remember the Constitution. We remember the way things were. We remember law and order. We remember families that were intact, husband, wife, children. That's the memories of the past that were in the minds of those prisoners, the intelligentsia, the peasants, the clergy who were against the communist rule. So that was the second enemy. Victory over this past, allegorically, was portrayed as construction of the canal, which became a symbol, a revolutionary change. And George then writes, George Grassley, how does one conquer the pre-revolutionary past since it continued to live in the minds of the prisoners? By killing them, of course. The historian Yuri Dmitriev from the Karelian Commission on the Rehabilitation of Former Political Prisoners under Stalinism in 2015 took photographer and writer Oleg Klimov into a forest near Belomor Canal searching for Stalin's hitherto unknown burial grounds from the 1930s. Klimov wrote that along the canal there are scores of them, many of which have not yet been identified. It's the purpose of my life as a person and as a historian to look for the tortured and executed, but a whole lifetime still isn't enough. Now, from archival documents, I can confirm and point out the pits and ditches where Czechists burned or buried around 86,000 people in this wonderful project, Belomor Canal. The mortality rate of prisoners reached 14% for the entire period of construction. Between 100,000 to 200,000 were died or were shot. So that is what our young people, products of our colleges and universities, now two of them working for the Bernie Sanders campaign, and trust me, Bernie Sanders knows exactly what they think and what they're saying. And so does the left in this country. They disguise it, they hide it, but this is exactly what they have in mind. And that reminded me of something I wish I had more time to talk about. I'm not sure I have even time to play this. Larry Glathwell was... I'm going to have to tell this quickly. The Weather Underground was the manifestation of the communist left, one of them. It's a part of the Students for Democratic Socialists. That was in the 60s. And they came, the Weather Underground became more radical than the just plain communist youth movement. And it was led by Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers. You've heard their names probably. Their names, I've known them forever. Because I followed all of this even when it was happening. But when Barack Obama ran for president or started running for Senate, I was in Chicago working on Alan Key's campaign, and that made me unlock a lot of information. And so I was able to view, I remembered a documentary I'd seen on PBS in the 80s that did an expose of the Weather Underground, which you can't find anymore. They won't let you see it. But what we still do have is an interview with Larry Grathwell, who was an FBI plant with the Weather Underground. He actually joined to get information. And we will play just a little bit of this. This is Larry Grathwell back way, way back. I think he's dead now. I want you to hear what the Weather Underground were saying at that point. Let's listen. 16.
I brought up the subject of what's going to happen after we take over the government. We become responsible then for administrating, 250 million people. And there was no answers. No one had given any thought to economics. How are you going to clothe and feed these people? The only thing that I could get was that they expected that the Cubans and the North Vietnamese and the Chinese and the Russians would all want to occupy different portions of the United States. They also believed that their immediate responsibility would be to protect against what they called the counter-revolution. And they felt that this counter-revolution could best be guarded against by creating and establishing re-education centers in the Southwest.
All right, I'm going to interrupt him. We're going to have to play the rest of that tomorrow. But he goes on to say, I could not believe I was sitting in the room with college-educated elites, young people, Bill Ayers, William Ayers, and Bernadine Dorn, who, by the way, are the University of Chicago and Northwestern, respectively, right now. And they were planning to kill 250 million Americans after they'd taken over in the revolution. It's not a new thought. It's what the left really thinks at the heart of it. I just want you to know. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.